Project Camelot Whistleblower Radio. Good evening, and how's everyone out there tonight? This is a Friday night, and it's June 8th. I have a very interesting guest who has actually been on my show before. His name is Peter Moon. He's a publisher, and he's very involved in the whole Montauk story, has published a number of books with Preston Nichols and Stuart Swerdlow and a number of other people in that regard. And he's also gotten involved in a more recent story that has to do with an installation that was found within the Romanian mountains. And the book that we're going to be discussing is Transylvanian Sunrise. There's also another one called Transylvanian Moonrise. And I guess the third book in the series that regards Egypt. And so we'll also probably try to touch on some of that as well. Wanted to make a couple of announcements just before we start here. First of all, I have, if you go to our website, projectcamelot.tv or projectcamelot.org, we'll take you to the same place, or projectcamelotportal.com. All three of them go to the same place. And we're basically looking for subscribers to help support our work. We're offering a couple of things like free online events and or discounted ones depending on the cost, and also discounts on live events. In other words, when we do a conference here locally or someone where maybe in your area. And then we're also going to do a monthly Q&A. with Camelot. So you get those perks if you sign up, and we've got different levels at which you can, you know, contribute to our work. So $5, $10, whatever you want, a month kind of thing. And then we also have $100 a year subscription that gives you sort of a premier membership. And all of that is explained on our website. So if you just click on the top, you'll see it right when you go to the site. And please do support our work. We also have a new interview out that I just put out, I think it was yesterday, and it's with Joanne Richards, who is the wife of Mark Richards, who is involved in the Dulce battle. He's been framed for a murder he did not commit, and he is in prison and has been for the past 30 years. Apparently, according to his story, he is a member of the U.S. Space Command, and with he and his father and I guess grandfather were very involved in this secret space program, as well as apparently his grandfather was involved in Tesla's work and so on. So that's a very fascinating interview, and I'm also hoping to get a live interview with Mark Richards himself, assuming we can get past some prison protocol and see what happens with that. So I am waiting for more information. I also want to draw your attention to, Bill Brockbrader, who has contacted me, and he is also being framed in prison. They are saying he is a sex offender. He was never charged by the family of the girl who he was involved with when she was 16, and he was something like 25, from what I understand. This is something that the military drummed up after he had redirected a missile rather than destroying a group of an Iraqi settlement. And since then, his life has been kind of like hell, I think. But he's also been programmed massively, and he's tried to break through his programming. I've written several articles in regard to him, and I've also done, of course, the most well-known interview with him, which I still stand by. But I encourage you to take a look at those blog items that are there. There's more, believe it or not, on the blog. I've been pretty much pumping out the stuff. There's a long article that addresses an article written by Gordon Duff on Veterans Today in regard to Germany supplying Israel with nukes. And that's a pretty fascinating situation if you start to drill down into it. We've also been investigating here on Revolution Radio the spikes in radiation in Chicago. I notified Dutch Sense, and he ran down that road, and I understand that it's now been posted over on Alex Jones. So there seems to be something going on with the Chicago area. It does not appear to be a Fukushima-related incident. It seems to be something that has to do with some local nuclear power plant, but no one is talking, so we don't have any real information on that other than the spikes in radiation that are quite drastic, actually. So there was also an attempt on Falcone's life. In fact, three of them. I wrote an extensive article analyzing that situation, which is also on my blog, and also posted the White Hat report, which is report number 42, that outlines what happened during those attempted murders of Falcone. And Falcone is one of the people involved with the money behind the global settlements, whose money was stolen by the Bush cabal and put into what are called trading programs. And from there, he basically lost track of it, never saw it again. We're talking about millions of dollars. He went and testified in Germany against a guy named Michael Herzog, who is a pretty nefarious character. And as a result, they have attempted to kill him three times. I assume at some point they may be successful. And I have a lot to say about that situation. So that's about it for updates. Peter Moon, are you there?
I'm there.
Awesome. Okay. So how are you tonight?
I'm fine, thank you. It's nice to be here.
Lovely. Well, it's great to have you, and I think a lot of people will be very, very interested in hearing this discussion in regard to, the books that have to do with Radu Sinemar's story. That is very complex, and I'm happy to have you sort of introduce not only yourself but also the story in whatever way you think is appropriate.
Well, I'm primarily known for the Montauk Project series, which was published 20 years ago in 1992, which starts with the recollections of Preston Nichols combined with a synthesis of other people's stories, most of which are under the table. These people never came forward, and Preston sort of synthesized all the stories, and I put it into simple English language, particularly his theories about time. And the Montauk Project is a very controversial book, in part because some of it, or lots of it, can't be verified by normal journalistic means. But what it did do, it definitely changed the whole paradigm of how physicists looked at time. And, you know, Stephen Hawking changed his position. Many other people have changed their position. And then along came Dr. David Anderson to further the theories or the basic idea that time can be controlled. That's primarily how I'm known as Peter Moon. And I have, of course, published and authored many other books with a few other authors as well. Most of what I've done is on the subject of synchronicity, because when I sought to verify the time experiments, I encountered the phenomena of synchronicity at what I would consider to be an unprecedented level for normal human experience. So I've written a lot about that. And all this Montauk Project book is very important because it went into Romania. And a man, Sorin Hormuz, saw the book. He was an editor at a publishing house, and the editor said, "Should we publish it?" He said, "Yeah, we should." The publisher didn't want to publish it, so he started his own company and published it himself, and that created Doxa Publishing. And when this book, The Montauk Project, went into circulation in Romania, a Radu Sinemar saw it, and he said, "I have had a experience and a book that you might be interested in." And this started the book, which we now know in English as Transylvanian Sunrise. And this is a very, as you've read, is a very unique story and is a very intriguing story. It's essentially about the U.S. military discovering with ground-penetrating radar from satellite technology, that there was a chamber beneath the Romanian Sphinx. The Romanian Sphinx is high above the tree line in the Bucegi Mountains of Romania, near the border of Transylvania. And there is another famous megalith up there within about 100 yards called Babele, which means old woman. It's like Babylon, Babele, or Babel. And that underneath, there's a chamber, according to this ground-penetrating radar, which they didn't know what was in it. They wanted to discover it. So the Romanians were eventually approached, and this is what this book is about, how the chamber was accessed, all the political intrigue, which is quite intriguing and quite blow-by-blow. And that's the general introduction to the story of what Transylvanian Sunrise is about. Most people aren't even aware that there is a Sphinx in Romania. And it's the most popular tourist attraction in Romania, by the way.
Yes, and you have a picture of it on the cover of the book as well.
Right, and there's a picture of me next to it inside the book, taking a photograph of it.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Well, it's an absolutely fascinating story, and for me, it actually seems to link up with the Wingmakers information and. I wasn't sure whether you were aware of that information, but it seems a person that you're working with, if I recall, her name is Sandy. Do I have the name right?
Sandy Sabatini. I'm not working with Sandy. She's a friend of mine. She set up Otherworld Radio, and she's doing the Pythagoras Conference this October.
Okay. I don't know if it's her that I'm talking about, but there's someone who had a dream that actually related to the site itself. And they seem to be tapping in on a subliminal level to what the Wingmakers had, James of the Wingmakers had published years ago on his website about sites, special sites that would be found around the globe. Seven number is what he said at that time. And Chaco Canyon is one of them, in which there was a kind of an installation left behind by beings who were aware that humanity, they were sort of guardians of humanity, and they wanted to help protect us from future events by installing a certain kind of technology that's very sophisticated, as well as apparently a sort of library of information in these sites. And then there's also the idea that if you discover the sites, they become activated. And when they become activated, they link up. A little like activating your chakras. So in a sense, they would be a kind of earth chakra, although they're not the traditional ones that are thought of to be the earth chakras, which are, if you study this sort of thing, fairly well known. For example, LA having the throat chakra of the earth and so on. But these particular sites are put on a map. They're on the wingmakers.com site. They're sort of shown in general geological areas. I am not sure if one of them is in the Romania area, but everything about this thing, the situation in that site, what was discovered there, how it activated the one in Iraq, etc., seem to point to some very similar things going on there, and possibly the fact that it is one of the Wingmaker sites. So I have contacted James, just FYI, who I was involved with the Wingmakers material quite a while back in shopping that for a possible movie project. So I've alerted to him of your book and of this discovery. He may already be aware of it, but I'm hoping to get some feedback from them and to hear whether or not he wants to actually talk about it. But to get back to Radu Sinemar and to your relationship also with this sort of expert in time travel whose name is Anderson. What's his first name?
David, Dr. David Anderson.
David, yes, yes. Who's a very fascinating man in his own right and someone who is also somehow wrapped into this story. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, Dr. David Anderson approached me in 1999 on August 11th. He came into a meeting we were having on Long Island he was already a subscriber to my newsletter with an address called the Time Travel Research Center on Long Island, which I did not really realize was a serious operation at the time. I saw, you know, his initial letters. I think I still have them, but I thought he was just some kid with stationery. He turned out to be quite a substantial figure. He came to our meeting, listened to everything Preston Nichols had to say, who was speaking that evening, and approached me afterwards and said he wanted to work with me. And I now, looking back and having talked to him many times since then, realized that he had a great appreciation for what I had done, because most people in the world he was dealing with had very closed minds with regard to the possibility of time travel and the actual mathematics that it requires to understand time travel. You have, and here's a big difference between physicists and engineers. He is an engineer who became a physicist. And engineers like to build bridges. They like to build things. And I didn't realize this at the time, because I'm not a physicist. I don't have a physics background. But there's a lot of tension between physics and engineers. Engineers do things. Physicists have a tendency to theorize, and generally speaking, not exclusively, but they don't do anything. They pontificate, they talk about superstring theory, they talk about this theory, they talk about this theory, they hypothesize, and they don't do. David Anderson was very much a doer, and when he spoke about things, he spoke functionally. And he recognized the same principle in me, although I'm not building time travel devices. So we got along really good. We went out to lunch, and he was telling me that he had a foundation that he had just returned from Romania, his first trip to Romania, and the conference called Atlanticron. It was in 1999, where he was invited to speak as a replacement for some German speaker, and he said he wanted me to go to Romania. I would like it there. He was very much intent on getting me to Romania. It took actually about 9 years to get me there, but I didn't make it. And in the meantime, these books were published. David, I was particularly intrigued when I learned about this radar, this ground-penetrating radar from the satellite, because David explained to me that the reason he got into time travel was in the Air Force when he was asked to solve a problem with their satellites were drifting a few meters in space every year, and they would generally eventually lose their ability to do like GPS functions or whatever the functions were. It's very important that satellites stay in the same place. So he created a space-time model, and as he had a very strong background in math, he figured out an extension or extrapolation of Einstein's special theory of relativity, whereby space and time could be warped to maintain these satellites. And there were actually algorithms involved, geometric algorithms or algebraic algorithms, and he patented them. But that was not until he got out of the Air Force. But he set up a private company to do this because the Air Force was not interested in furthering the time potential of this. When they actually got an idea of what he was doing, he already asked to leave. They tried to make him stay. They played games with him. He had to petition Jay Rockefeller, who was either his senator or his governor at the time, to get out of the Air Force because he didn't really like the way they were treating him. He got out of the Air Force. He set up his own time travel research center, which was called a security company, and he was controlling time on a small scale, which was about the size of a soccer ball, whereby he could slow time down or speed it up. Now, in April of, I think it was 3 years ago, it was 2 or 3 years ago, I don't remember, but it was in April of 2 or 3 years ago, out at Montauk, he appeared at a presentation that was hosted by Sandra Sabatini. She hosted it. I had gotten him to appear. He wanted to meet with me. I said, why don't you come to the meeting? I didn't announce him. Nobody knew he was coming. I surprised the crowd with him, and I can say I'm going to Romania this year with Jeanette Crowley on a tour. I'm going to be helping her. I can't promise that Dr. Anderson's going to appear at any of my future appearances, but he did appear at that one, and he showed us a video of the early version of his time chamber, which had an amaryllis plant, which would take normally 4 days to bloom, took 3 minutes. And we all saw it. There were over 20 of us there, and it was fascinating. And he did not allow me to video it or even record it because he has partners, meaning the government or the secret government, which he hasn't gotten clearance. And this is why his videos have never come online like he wanted to. There have been problems with his technology being forwarded. He did appear on Coast to Coast a couple years ago and announced that he was putting humans in the time chamber. It went over very excitingly. There was a lot of fanfare about it. He also announced that his time reactor technology, which the patents have now been shown, there's one on my website, digitalmontauk.com, where you can see one of the patents that he has released or filed for. I have a clear explanation of it in the book Transylvania Moonrise, which is the most easy to understand explanation. It used to be on his website, which is now no longer there for the time being. And it explains how the time reactor would give us abundant energy. It totally solves the world's energy problems. I should add, it's not the only thing that would solve our energy problems, but it's one thing. So he is a godsend to science, a godsend to technology. But as he has explained to me many times, the government's technology is 15 to 20 years ahead of what the public knows. Preston Nichols used to say 50 years ahead of what the public knows. And they release it and piecemeal it out and decide who will get it. And it's all very like a controlled time release control program where they will say who gets what, and it all gets divvied up by the powers that be in this world, which includes the high-level military. That's a little bit about Dr. David Anderson, who I should also add has gone sort of off the radar for right now. He's, to the best of my knowledge, he's in India in an installation. The Indians have the most advanced time control research facilities there near Mumbai, and I believe that he is either there part of the time or most of the time working with them. And he's just, he's been attacked public relations wise by very irresponsibly human beings that are kind of knuckleheaded and slow to catch on. So he's just gone off the radar, and he's getting more work done by himself being alone. I will occasionally hear snippets of stuff going on with him, but nothing substantial and nothing worth to report.
Okay, well, thank you for that overview. That's great. And Dr. David Anderson, to some degree, it seems, was also something of the inspiration for the Matrix movies, I believe. And that was also the Anderson name was the name of the main character, if you recall. Okay, well, that's interesting. There's also more to this story than even happens in the first book, Transylvanian Sunrise, where you get into Transylvanian Moonrise and you're talking about Radu Sinemar meeting other individuals who are involved in things like, well, trying to live as long as possible. I'm not sure what you call it. It's not eternal life. It's prolonging life, life extension.
Virtual immortality. It's virtual immortality. It's alchemy, but I think it might be important, before we go on to that, to stress that what is found in the chamber in the Transylvania Sunrise.
Sure, absolutely, and I'm happy to go down that road.
You alluded to it a little bit, but it's basically, when they get into this chamber, it's a technology that would appear more futuristic than ancient, yet it is ancient, and there are tables that are 6 foot high, and when you put your hand over a certain section of the table, it's described in some detail. It reads out your DNA in a holographic projection. If you put it closer, it reads out it microscopically. If you put it yet closer, it reads it out atomically. Now, if you put your hand over another part of the table, it might read out another species, and it would show holographically the star system that the species came from. If you put your hands over that and another panel, it would show a hybridization of one species with another, including a human hybridization. So what you have here is a story that is very science fiction-esque, very evolved in terms of its idea or capacity for idea, and therefore very intriguing. The prospect of it being true will set about ontological shock in some people, because it takes the concept of Noah's Ark, which is basically rendered from the Old Testament two-dimensional story that's borrowed from ancient Egypt, and you have animals and DNA, and it's just a crude representation of something that this sort of supersedes in a very dynamic and alarming way. That's one feature of the chamber. There's also a feature called the projection hall, which tells the history of time according to the viewer. It's bioresonant with the viewer. So if Carrie gets in and sees it, it's going to be different than if I get in and see it. It's going to be different if somebody down the street gets in and sees it. It's going to be bioresonant with our hardware and software that are inside of us. It cuts off at about 500 AD, which they do not understand. And this is only after investigating the chamber for 6 weeks. That book is written with like 6 weeks of knowledge of the chamber. It's now been investigated for virtually nine years. So I don't know what else they found. There's also three tunnels in the projection hall, one of which goes to Egypt, which is the subject of the third book, Mystery of Egypt, one which goes to Tibet via offshoots to Baghdad in Mongolia, and the other one goes into the inner earth. Now, what I have liked about I look at these books two ways, or maybe three ways. I look at them as a reader, which is just enjoying the book. I look at it perhaps with a bigger, scrutiny than an ordinary reader, because I'm also publishing it. I also do an editorial viewpoint where, it just causes further scrutiny. But what I like about this book as an editor and as a reader is that there's four books in total. I'm working on the fourth one now. They're all incredibly diverse. They don't stick on the same subject and repeat it. They go into incredibly diverse discussions and incredibly diverse people and adventures that interconnect. And that takes us more or less to what you were starting to bring up, was Transylvanian Moonrise, the second book in the series.
Okay, yes, absolutely. I'm not actually done with Transylvania Sunrise in terms of going book by book. I'm actually a little more, I free associate a little more than that. But what I'd like to do is also sort of talk about the initial sort of investigator whose name is, in the book, he's called Caesar. I don't know if that's his real name. I kind of assume it's not.
It's not. They call it Cesar. Cesar is how you'd say it in Romanian, but we'll call it Caesar because that's what we're used to in American. Caesar Brad. And they tell us it's not his real name. It's a pseudonym. I'm born with a very large umbilical cord.
The character
Transylvanian Sunrise,
cannot
use cut it by the normal snip they use for most births. And this is a telltale signal for two reasons. Number one is the doctors in communist Romania, which it is communist at the time, are trained to report to the security of the government any strange anomalous birth, which they do. It's also a telltale signal to practitioners of Qigong, like I am, that this is where all of your life forces come through. All of the dark energy, which is your life force or energy comes through your navel. This is how you were born. You came through an umbilical cord. All of your energy came through the umbilical cord, and it all extends outwards from the umbilical cord. And this is many of the secrets of the martial arts and Qigong are through the energy that goes through your navel and spreads throughout your body through the fascia. But Caesar has a high quotient of natural life force by reason of this strong umbilical cord that they have to cut. Now, this puts him on the watch list, and they send immediately a Chinese doctor, Dr. Zhen. He's a exchange program with Red China, Communist Red China, and he's there to set up the Romania's Department Zero, which is their paranormal department for anomalous events, which most people here would understand as the X-Files sort of area of government. And Dr. Zhen examines him and over the years tutors him to become a competent, not only a psychic, but a competent leader who eventually is groomed to take over Department Zero, to be the head of Department Zero, which is going to play an integral role in uncovering this chamber of the Sphinx. So this is all being set up by a mysterious character named Dr. Zhen, who is a paranormal expert from Red China, who mysteriously disappears when Romania communism falls, and he just disappears, and nobody knows where he goes when communism falls and capitalism takes over. And that's sort of where he's very much a mysterious character in book one.
Yes, and then I guess he reappears in book two, correct?
Yeah, he reappears in book two and in book four. But he reappears in book two as a Tibetan Lama. But you don't find out he's Dr. Zhen until they get into the book, and this is where they have Caesar disappears from book two. He's not in there at all. This is what makes it so fascinating. You have all these characters interacting, and they know of each other sometimes. Sometimes they know each other, sometimes they don't. And, of course, Dr. Zhen appears as a Tibetan Lama who's seeking out Radu, the author, because he has an agenda for him as well. And that becomes the subject of book two.
Actually, what I'd like to do is just go down a short road with regard to Caesar, or however you say it, and talk about the idea that he was the only one who could go in and actually activate or open this sort of closed, or these closed chambers, so that he had to activate it through his frequency, so that other people could come in and out of the place. Otherwise, the military even was unable to access it. Isn't that right?
That's correct. In fact, they have a hard time opening up the chamber with all this atomic laserware that they're using, very high technology that's not even been released to the public, to try and get to the chamber. And they're having a hard time. When they have a hard time getting in hardware-wise. When they finally they open it up, but then there's a block. It's been so long, I don't remember if the energy block or a wall block, but basically,
well, it's like a force field that goes across sort of this cave-like chamber, and so he what he does is he reaches his hand in through the energetic block itself, and which has just killed three people prior to that when they just came in contact with it.
Outside of it, there was sort of a pyramid looking, or a triangle looking thing, and he puts his hand in resonance with it. In other words, it recognizes his DNA. It recognizes his DNA, and that opens the energy field. It's bioresonant with Caesar. Now, we can assume that it was particularly resonant with his. We don't really know that. It might have worked with yours. It might have worked with somebody else's. He was smart enough to figure it out. But it might work with other people's besides his. But it did work, and he was the one who figured it out, which tells us that he was meant to be there, and that chamber was not going to be opening without him. And this is a, I guess what you call a puppeteering of the timeline and orchestrating the timeline so that he can open this chamber so that it can be accessed. And in the meantime, there's all these nefarious characters trying to get at the chamber through the Italian Freemasonry, you know, the evil guy in the book, Signor Mazzini, is trying to get at this, and he's rebuffed by the circumstances. And Caesar is able to access the chamber, and up through the third book, and even, you know, this is pretty much the domain of Caesar. He is the person in charge of this whole domain. He has to work with the Americans. The Americans are partners with the Romanians because the Americans have the technology, the Romanians have the territory. It is an uneasy partnership, and there is a lot of corroboration in newspaper articles in Romania, which are featured in the beginning of book two, telling us corroborative elements that this story does in fact have legs to it. We don't get verification of everything because this is top security, one of the highest secrets, if not the highest secret, of Romanian and American intelligence. So we give corroborations of the story, and this is also the uniting of Romania with American as partners, and Romania becoming a part of NATO, which it never was. So there's a lot of corroborative evidence in the beginning of the second book.
Right. And the other thing is this, to get back to this frequency issue, this is something that goes on and also has to do with stargates as well. So it has to do with the frequency of the individual, and it's particularly fascinating for me, that particular element, in part because of an interview I did with a group that's studying yoga and also talking about remote viewing, who have been sort of harassed by the police, and that there has been a tradition in Romania, as well as some other countries, of cracking down on individuals who wish to study the higher mind and get into higher frequencies themselves through using yoga and various other disciplines. So this is this sort of factors in here. It also is happening in other power places around the globe, including the pyramids, where they don't want you to meditate in the temples, etc. So there's something to be said for all of that, and what it allows one to have access to. So as far as this device, though, and it really does just graze the surface. Most of the book is involved in discovering and the background around that that particular book. It's absolutely fascinating because you do follow Caesar's life throughout the book, and he's a very interesting individual. And Raju Sinemar, at least in that book, is less so, but in part it becomes his journey. And then the next book is involved more so with Raju Sinemar. And I haven't finished the second book, but I don't think that, it's not my understanding that Caesar shows up anywhere in that. Does he?
No, he does not. And that makes the book interesting in itself, because Radu is very nondescript in the first book. He's just really a writer, a narrator. At the very end, he talks about his own experiences in the chamber, where he doesn't say much about his own experiences. He reveals that, I think that's in book three, he reveals what he sees. He reveals maybe a little bit in the first book. But he's not really a character. He's brought in by Caesar to write the book. That's his purpose. He is handpicked for whatever reason to write the book. And then the Lama, I guess, sees his potential as a communicator and handpicks him to get this manuscript in Tibet, which is translated in book four. And so, you know, his value is seen as a writer, as a communicator, and And then he also is singled out for other abilities because he's developing his psychic talents as the book the book series goes along.
Okay, and so, I mean, all of this is very, very fascinating, and in a sense, there seems to be a very interesting link up as well to the Montauk books and to the idea that, what they both have in common certainly is time travel and the idea of accessing other dimensions. And there also, what's very important about this discovery in these mountains for people that are listening, the Camelot audience, which is aware of a lot of information that we come across in regard to what are called the Anunnaki, something to the degree of what Sitchin has revealed about the Sumerian tablets, but for the bottom line being that they are tall beings. And these, the particular installation, this sort of book of records, as I heard it called, archive of records, whatever you want to call it, this sort of hologram technology, it exists on tabletops that are beyond the height of the normal human, so that you need to use a step stool in order to see the top of the table and actually utilize the technology at all.
They're 6 feet high. They're 6 feet high, they're described.
The top of the table. So what happens is that basically alludes, to the idea that they were installed by a group of very tall beings, and that becomes very, very interesting when you're looking at our history, the history of humanity, and what this particular installation is all about, why it was put there, et cetera, et cetera, why it's so heavily guarded at this time, and why it hasn't even been announced to the rest of the world. In fact, I don't know. You can tell me. As far as I know, your book is the only thing out there in the Western world that talks at all about it. Isn't that right?
Well, I would say this. I would say that there was actually somebody put up a website astrologically about the great discovery of August 2003. And this is, somebody put up a website, some astrology person, about this discovery, because this was before it came out in English. They must have had some bits or pieces of it translated from the Romanian about this great discovery. Somebody put up a website. It didn't go very far. It was not full of much information, but it did announce the discovery. What was interesting about the August 2003 is when this was discovered, is it coincides with the biorhythms of the Philadelphia Experiment and the Montauk Projects, which occurred in August, between August 10th and 14th of every 43, 63, 83, 2003, 2023, every year that's a major biorhythm. And there are often strange coincidences or noteworthy, like there was also in 2003, August, there was a big blackout in the East Coast, the epicenter of which was Preston Nichols' new property in Cairo, New York. And This is also significant, which suggests that the projects are somehow related. But when you get into space-time projects of any sort, they're all related by their very nature. So this is why they're all resonant with each other, because they're all changing time and space, just like all cell phone towers are connected to each other in some way, even if they're not plugged into the same exact modalities, they're still connected. But they're pretty much connected. Same with space-time projects. And this is why there will be a resonance as more space-time projects get revealed. And although we have had some space-time projects revealed here and there, by and large, not too many.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, well, eventually we're going to, I think, recognize ourselves as time travelers, period. But at this time, that understanding of humanity itself is not common. So what we should do at this point, I think, maybe, is talk a little bit about the second book and what is encountered there. And what I'd like to do is, we've got about 15 minutes left to the top of the hour. And I also like to take questions in the chat for the people that are listening. and ask them to put their questions in all caps. And then we also have the ability for people to call into the radio station. So we'll talk about the second book, and then sort of, Peter, at your own discretion, we can start taking calls anytime.
Well, you can take calls anytime you want, as far as I'm concerned. The second book, while you wait for somebody to call in, is about Radu being contacted through an intermediary by the Tibetan Lama. The intermediary is a very interesting character named Eleanor. And Eleanor has a hard time getting through. He's talking to the publisher. So I do believe, knowing the publisher, I do, who has not met Radu personally, or so he says, he has spoken to Eleanor. And Eleanor turns out to be a character who looks like he's 27, but he's really 60 years old, according to his driver's license. And while they're waiting for the Tibetan Lama to arrive at Eleanor is a male name in Romanian, at his villa in Bucharest, there's this incredible conversation that ensues about alchemy, because he is a practitioner of a tradition of alchemy where he was sought out by one of his ancient ancestors, who had lived for hundreds and hundreds of years and was looking for a worthy descendant in his genetic line to pass this information on to. It's not passed on to anybody, basically how to live a long time. And this particular ancestor was kidnapped or taken as a spoil of war at a young age. He lived with a king in Persia, and he was then traded to a magician in India, where he went with the magician and learned the art of alchemy. He was treated nicely, and he learned this ancient art, and then he lived for hundreds and hundreds of years, and became a practitioner of it. And it's an art that you learn over a long period of time. It's not something you learn in a university course. And Eleanor shows this incredible geometric device that keeps him young. It's a rhomboid that looks mesh-like. The alloy is very mysterious in that it appears to be moving, but it's not moving. It took a long time to make the alloy, and then this mesh is kind of like a net with a cube around a sphere, and inside the sphere is a tetrahedron, and I think it's bluish and reddish, and then inside is a crystal. Inside of the pyramid is a crystal, and the crystal is made to turn violet. And that's the whole secret, is getting the frequency. You're talking about frequencies, getting it to turn violet and tuning it to the vibration of the individual. And it extends the life of an individual through vibration. Vibration is a very key aspect. Vibration can also transmute radiation. And a lot of these radiation scares that we're having are not necessary. People go into panic because they don't have any technology or are not aware of any technology to neutralize or transmute radiation. But anyway, this transmutes
the
vibration of the body.
Yeah, and that's a very good point. I've actually talked about that myself. But the thing is that a lot of people don't have that ability or technology or don't know that they have it. And this is where, the radiation sort of panic starts with people.
Totally understandable.
Yeah.
They can look up Agnihotra, Agnihotra, copperworks.com. And this there's actual, it's biodynamic technology. Biodynamics teach you how to transmute radiation. Doesn't destroy it, doesn't negate it, it transmutes it. And I've been learning from biodynamic people in Long Island. It's a lost art. It goes back to the work of Rudolf Steiner. The Anastasia books also touch on it, but this is something that people can release their frustrations on with Agnihotra, ancient Vedic therapy, because the Vedic people of ancient years had all sorts of atomic problems. But they're finding this in history. We've had an atomic war on this planet before. So this is stuff that's recurring. But that's a side issue to what we're talking about, but it should be mentioned because we want to release as much frustration and anger as possible on these issues. They don't help.
Yeah, it's something that's very good for people to hear, and I'm glad to hear you give a reference for some place that they can go. Simply that we do have that capability in our DNA, in our sort of what is made up of this humanness that we have. So to get back to the story in terms of the longevity aspect of it, in a sense, it was my understanding to some degree that the alchemy centers around the philosophy. Is it called the Philosopher's Stone?
Right. But yeah, the whole idea of transmuting base metals into gold, which is also a metaphor for transmuting lower energies into higher energies. And this has been a continual stumbling block to people who read my work and the work that I've published, and they stay right at the level of mind control, MKUltra, and they don't take it any further. These are very negative vibrations, which I certainly never intended anybody to sit there and keep bending their gray matter over mind control, because mind control is something that exists, but you have to move in beyond it. Too many people in the conspiracy circuit or the abduction circuit, UFO circuit, become advertise their victimhood, and they've been victimized, there's no question of that, but it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. One has to transmute those negative energies and not be talking about them 5 or 10 years from now, and hopefully not 6 months or a year from now. You have to transmute them, and there are people who do this, who have transmuted and overcome their difficulties. But alchemy, that phrase of alchemy, is people will have a tendency to take things to the lowest common denominator. You want to take them from the lowest common denominator and move them higher. And the Philosopher's Stone is, you know, base metals into gold. It relates to the going into the brain. White monoatomic gold was the ancient process of the ancient Egyptians to fully activate the brain. And all these things are metaphor for full consciousness and full understanding, which we are not participating in as the human race. We're using limited consciousness and limited illumination. And all of these, there's more ways than one to arrive at these things, and there's many different traditions and disciplines. This particular individual, Eleanor, is exercising one particular, there's a couple of disciplines involved that he's involved with, but it's completely different than the Tibetan Lamas. They are aware of each other, they respect each other, but they're different disciplines. And the whole idea in reading this book, I would say, it was very important to me to read this book because I was reading it, I guess the first one to read it in the English language, and was totally marveling at the fact that, God, I would have paid all the money I'm paying the translator to read the book. It was that good. It was the best book I ever read. Like, it's cluing me on some secret to live a long life, longer than what I would have ever thought. I've extended my horizons to living a long life to 150, 200 years by practicing Taoist Qigong. That's using the full extent of the breathing of the lungs, which human beings only use 5% of their lungs, so their organs die. When you use all of each one of the lobes of your lungs, feeds a specific organ. So if you're breathing with all of your lung capacity, your organs are not going to fail. That's old age. Now, there are other techniques besides just breathing, but breathing is very important. Now, if not the most important, this technique that Eleanor is teaching us is vibrational, which does not contradict the Qigong. It's vibrational, and he's talking about living hundreds and hundreds of years, even thousands of years with certain elixirs, which he does not go into. Now, the whole purpose, according to him, of living a long life is to transcend the physical plane, and this is something along the lines of an ascended master. Now, he says that most people take 300 or 400 years. it's a long process, but that's not long in terms of normal, in terms of history. It's long to our human bodies. So everything, as in Qigong we say, slower is better. So this was a completely new prospect with the idea that, wow, my paradigm was shifting. It was opening up. I never intended to live a long time, never particularly wanted to. Now, if you're being given the gift of life, it's best to take it and not refuse it. What's very interesting in this whole paradigm is that was told by Radu last Christmas. He sent me a letter for Christmas and said that I would meet Eleanor in the next 10 months. So I will actually am slated to meet this individual. It will be a very short meeting, and I believe it will begin a chain of events where the players, and this is all as a result of what happened in the last 2 weeks, where the players of Montauk will meet some of the players of the Romanian time travel. In other words, it may open up dialogue for Radu to meet Preston and Duncan and some of the care, and myself, of course, he's wanted to meet for a long time, and get some interplay where you had suggested that these projects are connected. So it would seem that they're far more connected than even I would have suspected, because I only recently introduced these stories to Preston and Duncan in a way that I was acting as an ambassador for the Romanians, in a sense, saying, you know, they told me a long time ago they want to come, but now it looks like it's going to happen in 2013, which was a big year for Montauk, according to the ancient readings that were done in ancient 1990s, and what they were coming up with. 2013 was a big blockage or a stepping stone on the timeline.
Okay, yes, absolutely. And I think that this will all be of great interest to people that are listening, and that there has got to be a very strong link up there. My understanding is that David Anderson also plays a pretty significant role here. And I also just intuitively feel that he is also something of a time traveler. And that's part of what he is involved in as well. So, in other words, I believe all humans are time travelers, but some people are certainly more aware of it and are sort of, in being conscious of their abilities in that way, maybe utilizing things such as living very, very long and times and so on. So I don't know whether you've ever discussed that with him in any depth.
I've discussed many things with David. One thing David did tentatively agree to it. I mean, when it's going to happen, I say tentative. I said I'd love to have him and Preston on camera talking about time. He says, I'd love to do it. Of course, when that happens is, you know, they've met each other, you know, at least a couple of times, maybe more. But David seems to be the linkage, although he does not claim to know anything about Romania, about the Romanian events. But if he is connected to Radu claims that he does not know David. He says he'd like to meet him. If David is connected to the Romanian events, I believe it would be more through the Lama, because I know David's gone over to China, and he studied there with Buddhist monks. I know he's been in the Himalayas. Don't know if he's been into Tibet per se. It wouldn't surprise me at all. When I was at his apartment years ago, he had a Christmas card from the president of China he showed me. A New Year's card. They don't send Christmas cards. And he's learning Chinese, by the way. So he speaks a lot of languages. He doesn't really like to talk about that. But it wouldn't surprise me at all if he had connections. And why I say that is because David has a access to the heads of world governments. I saw that in his house when I was there, all these cards from all these heads of state. And he told me about his meetings with them, what they're like. He says world leaders have a very hard time. They don't know why they're selected the position. They try to do the best they can. He says they have a very hard time. It's a different lens than, say, somebody who's talking Bohemian Grove stuff. because he's seeing them on their jobs. I don't even know that the ones he sees go to the Bohemian Grove. I really couldn't tell you. But it's more of a hands-on sort of view that he's had. And I got the impression, it's been a long time, that his reason for being with these world leaders had something to do with his expertise with nuclear weapons. He has a lot of credibility, but all of these cards were sent to the Time Travel Research Center. And he dialogued back and forth as a, you know, as the president of the Time Travel Research Center, and they all seemed to take an interest. So this seems to be a sort of a closet aspect of world leaders that you don't necessarily see. And if you talk to people like Stuart Swerdlow, who is a, you know, mentalist, he will tell you stories of how all these world leaders have psychics around them, and there's like these games that go on between the psychics. You know, this world leader is protected by these psychics and that one's not, and they're fighting each other and playing all these psyops games, which and anyway, I do believe David Anderson is a link, but his role is mysterious, and his accessibility is extremely mysterious. Like, when I was in Bulgaria, I went to Bulgaria 2 years ago, and my Bulgarian friends just visited me. I was being taken all around to sacred sites. He had actually gone to Bulgaria to visit my friends there for the first time. I met him in Romania, and he was monitoring my trip the whole way through, and we were emailing. Basically, I think he was primarily concerned about my safety, which I was safe at all times. I was in good hands. But, you know, he appears in my life and then disappears in my life. And right now he's disappeared. But he will reappear. Just all these characters, just like with Radu. The Lama appears, the Lama disappears, Eleanor appears. Eleanor disappears. When he wrote to me in Christmas, he told me Eleanor he'd seen. Wow, he said he did this incredible demonstration for him. And apparently part of the agenda for me to meet Eleanor is to substantiate some of his claims. He wants to substantiate more of what he said. It's hard to do because of security issues. So this is a slow unfolding drama that will take many years to manifest itself, and you know, nobody knows exactly where it's going to go, but it should go in the direction of more revelation, understanding, and enlightenment on some of these very exotic matters.
Well, no doubt about it. And just wanted to say that Joseph Mazzini, of course, is a person who's written a time travel sort of saga in Aang's hat, which is, he's also somebody that you and I became connected through Joseph Mazzini as well. And that was sort of an interesting side trip. And when we wrote a screenplay, you know, a pitch for doing a Montauk movie, if you recall. So there are some very interesting link ups there, as well as with Aleister Crowley and Jack Parsons and JPL and NASA and so on. So it's kind of a labyrinth of connections, really.
They go much deeper. Joe's knowledge of the occult is such that it really can't be spoken about, and he doesn't talk about it that much when he gets on the air. It's just better off not spoken about. When I speak with him about it, it's best spoken, because many of the things I talk to him about, he'll tell me nobody else understands. I have my own specialized understanding. I do not have his specialized understanding, and where it sort of meets is synchronicity. And He's very knowledgeable. He's doing, you know, he's doing a lot of media work now, which is very important.
Okay, we're back. Carrie, are you
okay
there?
I'm here.
Yes, I'm right here. Thank you very much. Okay, Peter, we're here with Peter Moon, and we're going to open the floor for questions. And so you can either call in, and I believe the phone number is on freedomslips.com, or you can also type into the chat your questions and put them in all caps so that it's easy for me to figure out what's a question besides the ongoing chat between everyone. someone has got a question right here, so I'm just going to start taking questions unless you wanted to say something specific about, either book two or something else in regard to our discussion.
It's time for questions. Go ahead.
Okay. So we have someone asking, isn't our pineal gland our stargate time gate?
That got garbled. I couldn't understand it.
Oh, okay. Someone is asking whether the pineal gland is our stargate / time gate.
Well, I don't claim to be an expert on the pineal gland, but I would say that the pineal gland is what is your accessibility to those, part and parcel of your accessibility to those other parts of your brain. So it might not be that simple technically, but virtually speaking, I think the questioner makes a good point. It's part and parcel of it, I would say, in my opinion.
Okay. And let's see, there's some other questions here.
We have a Skype caller too, by the way.
Oh, all right. Let's go ahead and take that call then. Go ahead.
Hi, Carrie. It's Mike Hemmingson.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
Hey, Mike.
Hey, Peter. Hey, I was going to, I was wondering, I don't know, how did Al Bielek wind up in the future? 2749, was it, or something?
Well, Al Bielek, I can't really answer for Al, who's, passed away this last year. How did he end up in the future? I really couldn't answer that because Al had a resonance with everything time, time functioning, but I can't speak for Al. He had some stories that, and even his friends like Preston would say, some stuff he says, I can't accept what Al says. Some of it did sound plausible.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you had written about his interaction with the Wingmakers and all that.
No, I have not written about the Wingmakers. I have not written about Al Bielek. He was a friend of mine. I knew him. I used to talk to him, while he was on his last years. Mm. But I never endorsed his stories. I never not endorsed them. It was, he was never one of my writers. He was a friend, and he helped me in the beginning, understand. He told me about the Anderson brothers, the mysterious Anderson family, which was quite a neat thing when David Anderson came on the line. He said they were the custodians of time travel. but I really can't answer the question on Al.
Oops, my bad.
No problem. Still a good question, and thank you, Michael.
Thanks.
Okay, we have some other people here that are asking questions. Do you know anything about Project Looking Glass? Someone wants to know.
I never heard of it until I was on the radio with you and Sean, and I can't answer anything about Project Looking Glass. I know nothing about it other than these questions are better directed towards even yourself or Sean.
Okay.
Morton. It's just not my field.
Okay. This is a Camelot audience, so they tend to be referencing various things they've learned about on Camelot and then hoping to get kind of a cross-correlation with various researchers.
Unfortunately, most of my research is pretty narrowly focused, and so there's a lot of stuff that goes on the conspiracy circuit that I just don't even listen to. I hear about it, but I don't have time to delve into it.
Yeah, I don't know if you know it, but we had Preston Nichols on my show just a few weeks ago.
Well, I am aware of it because I got your phone number, and I do know that you had him on, but
it was a delightful show and a very interesting man. And that's no problem. Now, another person is asking, what do you know of the Hall of Records in Egypt? And then they're saying and Romania, but that's kind of...
That's a question I can give a response to. I was involved with some very interesting people when I got involved with the Montauk Project, one of which was Howard Metz. Howard Metz passed away, was over 10 years ago, and he was a pyramidologist. He he provided all of this information and research, which John Anthony West got all this credit for, with this erosion of the Sphinx. That was all Howard's work. Howard presented it to the Getty Foundation to help preserve the Sphinx when he was in Egypt. It just kind of happened by synchronicity. And Howard was a tremendous character, a tremendous intellect who had all this conspiracy stuff figured out before, you know, I mean, he would have been an incredible speaker if he was still around. But there was not only Howard, but there were other characters in and around him that were friends with him. What I learned from these people, because I was not the expert on Egypt, was that back after World War II, when the CIA formed, not right after World War, well, pretty close after World War II, the CIA went in and confiscated a lot of the information in the Hall of Records beneath the Sphinx. Now, there was a big pissing contest over whether there was a chamber there or not. Now, this is an interesting thing for some of these fans of Project Camelot, because there was a Senate. Well, John Anthony West won an Emmy Award for this. Charlton Heston presented it, this special on the Sphinx. And I had no idea it won an Emmy Award until I saw him at a talk talking about it. I said that show was an abomination of what was supposed to happen. I'm not saying that John Anthony West's information was wrong. I'm saying is what they avoided, because there was the Shore Foundation and a man named Bruno Casatelli, who I know, who had funded a lot of this excavation or investigation of this prophecy about the Sphinx and whatnot. The Hall of Records was going to be discovered about the Sphinx. Now, there was a friend of mine who was on that expedition, and she went down into this chamber because she was the one who knew. She was the one who knew. She's called Madame X in my books. She knew where it was, and she had everybody's heads turning. And they were allowed to go down into that chamber, but not with any cameras. There was a cinematographer who was the one doing all this footage, Boris Saeed, who's passed away now. He went down and took footage of this chamber beneath the Sphinx where there was water and whatnot. He was not supposed to do it, but he did it. And this footage was actually being sold via the Coast to Coast show for about $20 by Boris. And we want somebody to turn up this footage. My friend Joe Matheny wanted to see this footage. If somebody out there that bought this, it's very important because this shows a chamber beneath the Sphinx. Now, according to my friends, not these particular friends, that was all confiscated by the CIA right after the war. So we don't have those Hall of Records. But what I will tell you is when we get into Book 3, The Mystery of Egypt, the First Tunnel, it's an expedition where Radu is recruited to go on a job for Department Zero, and he goes with Caesar into these very modern cars, which go through the third or the first tunnel through Egypt into Egypt, and there is a chamber beneath the Giza Plateau, which is much older than either the Sphinx or the pyramid itself, where they do find a Hall of Records that is, I guess, they're slate type of thin. They would look, they'd be the equivalent to us of DVDs, and they read out holographic presentations of the history of the world. Now, there are so many, they can't even put them all in their cars on the way back. They're being taken back. I believe they're going to America. And it's going to take a whole team to study these things.
And Peter, when was this that Radu apparently went on this journey to Egypt?
About 2006.
Okay.
2006. Now, this Hall of Records in beneath the Giza Plateau, and also the one in Romania, which shows the history of the world, these would make any what you call typical archaeological Hall of Records that the CIA would have allegedly taken pale. Like, they can have all their, you know, hieroglyphic tablets, ho, ho, ho. It's not It's nothing. And this is one of the things that has really bothered the so-called Illuminati conspirators, is that this paradigm in Romania, and as it extends, has totally befuddled them. It's stuff that they didn't expect. It's stuff that they didn't know. It seems to be guidance from a higher plane of existence that is just confabulating and confounding them.
Well, there's also, I'm wondering if you're also referring to the labyrinth, what's known as the labyrinth.
There's a lot of labyrinths in the world. I don't know which one you're referring
well,
to.
Well, no, specifically the one in Egypt that is in the vicinity of the Egyptian, you know, the Giza Plateau. That Patrick Jarrell says that he went as part of an expedition that was trying to go into the labyrinth. They stopped him. They didn't let him go any further. I'm just wondering if this is the same area.
No, it's not. I don't know that specific labyrinth, but this area that goes, it's said in the book that there's a tunnel that was dug in ancient times towards this chamber, and it veers off. In other words, they knew where to go, but then it veered off, and they went in a different direction, and there was evidence of a big battle that took place there. So this chamber in the Giza Plateau that Radu talks about is kind of got its own self-protection. It wouldn't be part of it. It wouldn't be accessible by any normal means because, as they explain, the tunnel is actually not an actual tunnel. The other two tunnels are actual tunnels, but this tunnel is sort of a space-time distortion tunnel. So you're not actually traveling in a tunnel as we would know it. You're sort of traveling through a tunnel that is created in a parallel reality that looks just like a tunnel, but it seems to not have existence in all. Go ahead.
No, and that's part of this third book, the book. What's the title of the third book?
Mystery of Egypt, the First Tunnel, and it's available from Skybooks, skybooksusa.com. It's also on Amazon and in many bookstores across the country. Mystery of Egypt by Radu Sinemar.
Very good. 5604, by the way.
Okay, we've got a couple other questions coming in here. Somebody, when you say 604, this is a person calling in, is that right?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, 604, why don't you go ahead? We'll take your call now.
Excellent, sure.
Thank you.
This is SJ. And thank you, sir. What an entertaining listen. I wanted to ask you a question specifically that I've been trying to get information on concerning the Giza Pyramid. Are you aware of any large finds of wood that were unearthed in its vicinity?
Large finds of wood?
Large amounts of buried wood, yeah, in the vicinity of the Giza.
No, I can't say that, but I don't claim to be an expert on the pyramid. I don't know. I have friends who are, but I really don't know the answer to that.
Well, it was just a possibility that you might give me another little shred of information. One of the things I have been theorizing for a long time personally was using barges and basically walls and cofferdams to basically float the stones of the Giza into position. Would have made it a tremendously easier to build it. And at one time, I believe, the river was adjacent to the Giza.
Well, all I would say is I can't personally tell you how the stones were put in place, but I could tell you that what I've learned in Qigong, and Qigong is pronounced Qi in Japan, and Kemet in ancient Kemet. Qi is Qi. So Kemet would have a relation. And they used Qigong or Qigong. And you learn that the human bones can withstand up to 4 tons, can move 4 tons. This is with proper training. Muscles are good for 300 pounds. Bones are much stronger. So it's quite possible that those bones that those stones could have been moved with human, literally human labor, but it was a different type of human labor than we would know in our de-evolved state. There's also stories of levitation. It's just not my expertise.
Something of all this. Let me say that Antoinette Jigal, who is an Egyptologist, yes. A woman in Egypt, I've seen her presentations and met her when I was in South Africa doing an event with her. She talks about the water under Giza and the boats and the evidence of the boats and so on. And there was a tremendous amount of water in that area. So that does hold up in along with her research.
Can you repeat her name, Rebecca?
Her name is Antoinette. You can go on the Facebook. She's got a very active Facebook page.
It's
Antoinette.
G-A-L.
It's A-N-T-O-I-N-I-N. Antoinette. Jigal is the last name. G-I-G-A-L. She's French. G-A-L.
She's Egyptian. She's a friend of mine.
She's French.
Her name is French. But she is Egyptian, and she
lives... Yes, she lives in Egypt.
Right in the pyramid, practically.
Yes.
Very nice lady.
This networking is what comes out of these shows. It's so wonderful, you know, because it's so broad and covers so many different aspects. Thank you so much for talking to me. I'll sign off if you don't mind.
No problem. Thank you very much. We've got some other people here waiting to... Hi there. This is Carrie Cassidy, Project Camelot, Whistleblower Radio, and we're talking to Peter Moon. Peter, if you'd like, we can take a few more questions unless you wanted to say anything more about the book, the Mysteries of Egypt, that you had just started to mention.
Well, I would like to take some more questions. All I would say about that book is that, it goes in a completely different direction than we were in Transylvanian Moonrise. And it takes us on this adventure to... this chamber beneath the Giza Plateau where they encounter a time travel device. And there's the most interesting character in the book to me was an American who's named Aiden, who is sent from the Pentagon. He's a decryptor, and he has a laptop that the keyboard is holographic and it projects out holographically. And he said this is a extension of a bigger computer at the Pentagon. And he said, both computers tie into Hilbert space. Hilbert space is a mathematical is a mathematical concept of mathematics of different dimensions. So he says it's very interesting that this computer would literally tap into different dimensions. He said he is sort of telepathically connected to the electronics in the computer. He's a very gawky, geeky character, but he's very intelligent. And he helps solve some of the paradigms that they encounter. And it's a very interesting book. It's a controversial book, but it's a very interesting and...
Is this also written by Raju Sinemar?
Oh, yes, yes. Yes, I've committed myself to doing his four books. And I'm working on the fourth one now, which is The Secret Parchment... Five Tibetan Initiation Techniques, which is the revealing of the parchment that he uncovers in Book 2 with a lot of more political intrigue, his adventures in the remote viewing community in the United States, where he is sent, and he's not been allowed to write anything after Book 4. There's a lot of infighting in and around Department Zero that he talks about and some of that, and
okay.
It informed me in some of his letters as well.
Okay, very interesting.
Well, we can take more questions. That's about
okay.
All I wanted to say.
All right, well, wonderful. So obviously people listening will see that the plot thickens, as they say. Okay, we've got somebody who wants to know if you can discuss what they call the intricacies of the tech. They should have been a bit more. It looks like somebody named Jeff is asking this question. But intricacies of what tech regarding what? Because we're talking about actually more than one tech, as it were. But
do you
want to respond?
Technology? Does he mean technology?
Yes. Some technology, yes. He's referring to a technology, but which tech, I don't know.
I don't either. And, I mean, if you want, if he wants, I mean, the technology, I wouldn't say the technology is, I mean, we're given diagrams in the book. We're not given patentable technology where you can go out and create it. They don't even, they describe some aspects of it. How do you project holographically? I couldn't begin to tell you. Joe Matheny could give you an idea of how it would work generically. I can't say what their technology, if we're talking about the cars that they travel through the tunnel are, I believe he says, cold fusion. I couldn't explain the details. What technology? You there?
Yes, hello?
Oh, we have a caller, 904.
Oh, all right.
Maybe I should finish that question. That the time technologies, I can't give more precise. I mean, the book will give more than I gave, but I can't really give more precise. It's not even my technology or my story, but go ahead with the question.
Okay, all right. Thank you for the question. So, caller, you're on the air with Peter Moon and Carrie Cassidy.
Hello, Carrie. Hello, Peter. How you doing?
Hi.
Good.
I was wondering if Preston and yourself are going to do another book here recently or in an upcoming future with the things that may be coming down the line. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay. There are no plans to do another book with Preston right now. I did visit him. I don't see much of him anymore. We talk once every 2 months. But you know, he's more or less retired. And what I would say, I did see him last week with my Bulgarian friends. His state-of-the-art pyramid of sound has evolved much more beyond what it was. It's an incredible, most incredible sound machine I've ever heard. I did tell him about the Transylvanian projects, and he said that he had been to the chamber in his travels. I don't know whether that was through his music machine travels or what. He has his own paranormal experiences. He said he had been in the chamber. He said it was 50,000 years old. I said, that's what the book says. He says, I haven't read the book. I gave him the books, which he doesn't really read anymore because of his sight. And I told him, I gave him the synopsis of the three books. And I said, Preston, he's always said he's retired. And I said, you may have a role to play here. I don't know. He says, I do have a role to play. I said, what can you tell us about the chamber? He says, I really best not to talk about it right now. So he has his own insight. There are no books planned with Preston, mainly because Montauk is sort of past, it's sort of done, and only in the last couple of weeks has it kind of revived. When I say Montauk, I mean the players that were involved in it with the books and stuff. It's kind of getting a little bit more juice, and I think something will come along in 2013 which may require me to write a book. I don't know that Preston would be particularly involved. It's possible.
Okay, well, thank you for the very thorough answer. I want to say that the Preston said some similar things on my show. He seems to be holding some things very close to the chest, as they say, at the moment for some reason. I don't know if he feels threatened or whatever, but he maybe knows more than he's saying simply because he seems to be protecting himself a lot.
Well, I've seen Preston protect himself sometimes to the point of where I would think he was fear-based. In this particular case, sometimes he seemed to be coming from a place of knowledge and not fear, and that it was, sometimes it's just not best to reveal things because it's not going to do any good. And he's listening to the sensors that are sort of saying, not now, you know, it's just not time.
Sure,
to say
I understand.
It. And when it's,
yes.
When it's time, it will be.
Absolutely. Okay. Now, there are a few more questions here that I'm going to try to grab from the chat. I'm not sure if I'm kind of reading them quickly here. wants to know, somebody is talking about the timelines being changed through time and feeling that Montauk is very much alive. Do you want to respond to that?
The timelines, you know, time is a continuous stream. So everything that is in the past was and is. When I speak about Montauk being, you know, kind of over, I'm speaking of, you know, the phenomena of it as it existed. But he's right. All these things are existing simultaneously, and time is a very kinetic activity. It's happening all the time. The problem is we're in a localized or focused tunnel that we live in, and the interaction or dissolution of this becomes a whole different something that we have to deal with. And this is the challenge of time. Whether Montauk, you know, in this paradigm, Montauk, just in, I guess what I'm talking about culturally speaking, it was a phenomenon in the 1990s, and a lot of people are still catching on. They're still catching on. These issues that are coming to the forefront are reactivating all the time projects and timeline that he's referring to, how it all plays out. I mean, he made a good point.
Okay. Someone else is asking if the Caesar time travel story, which I'm referring to, just person who wrote this in the chat, the name of the book, again, is Transylvania Sunrise. It is linked on the front page of my website under Peter Moon's name, so that if you want to buy it, you can find the link there. He's asking if that time travel is a real story. I guess what he means is it true? And the information is apparently that it is true, according to everything that we're understanding and the fact that the governments are over there, the American government is over there, and that they are guarding this site very carefully. But, if you want to respond to that.
It's a very important question, if I understood it correctly. And what I would say is that the chamber that he goes to in beneath the Giza Plateau is a time travel chamber, but it only time travels your consciousness. You only travel with your consciousness. You don't travel with your physicality. And this is an important distinction. It's also bioresonant. In other words, there's censorship involved in the time travel device. You can't look at anything you want to, like they try to look at who made this device, and they're blocked from it. There's censorship involved. And in other words, if you go into it, you're going to see different things than me. And Caesar's going to see different things. So there's a REM factor, rapid eye movement factor, apparently. There's a bioresonance factor. And is it true? Well, it's true to the person who perceives it. I think if you were to have the opportunity to go into the chamber, you would see how it would link to other information. And so it's not necessarily true in an objective sense, but it's not untrue either. So much of the stuff in these books are bioresonant, and everything we perceive in our brains is bioresonant as well. And this seems to be a very key component of consciousness. It is the component of consciousness.
Okay, well, the question revolved around Caesar. My understanding, Caesar was involved in the Romanian device in the Romanian mountains, not in the Egyptian situation.
He was involved in the Egyptian and in the Romanian mountains, but the time travel device is in Egypt. It's not really specified that there's a time travel device in Romania. I think there is something similar to it, but the one in Egypt is really the biggest find they've had in this regard. I should also add that the Lama seems to be able to affect time translation without the use of a device. I don't know if I answered the question to your satisfaction.
Well, no, that's okay. That's fine. We can move on. Some people are asking, I'm not sure how this factors in, and you can certainly say that, you know, that it doesn't for you. But some people seem to want to ask about, they're saying somebody named Santos Benassi says that Jesus is a myth, and some say they went back to kill Jesus. Is this something related to any of this information that you're talking about?
The same sentence, Benassi, sounds familiar, but I can't place it. That was a theme that was brought up in Montauk Revisited. Stan Campbell, who was really Stuart Swordlow, went back in time to get Jesus' blood, actually, and to bring it. That's a wild story. But it came out of his submerged consciousness when he was in a trance. It didn't come out of him manipulating the information, at least consciously. In this story, Caesar goes back to the time of Christ, and somebody's trying to kill Christ. And then somebody said Christ was a myth. Is that what this said, that Christ
was a myth? Well, I guess the question is that this Benassi says Jesus is a myth.
He's not the only one to say that.
Right.
He's not the only one to say this. Caesar records experiences of having seen Christ, and according to his bioresonance, Christ is a real person. It might appear different. Christ is, of course, not a historical character according to the rules of history in scholarship. His knowledge of him comes through the scripture, which is scripture, which is not history. It doesn't mean it's not true. It just means scripture does not follow, this particular New Testament does not follow the rules of history. It follows the rules of religious scripture, which is right-brained. It has to do with belief as opposed to logical procedures. And
okay. I appreciate that. Now, someone else is asking about the hologram information being affected by expectations, mind, consciousness, etc. Is it your understanding that the hologram is bioresonant, as you called it?
I would expect bioresonant. But if you put your hand out and it reads out your DNA, then it's a scientific rendition. I would imagine if that's not your projection, that's bioresonant on a level that you are not influencing.
Right.
So there's a level where science, it's very important, and I stress this in the epilogue of the third book, is there's a right brain and there's a left brain. The right brain is creative. It is faith. It is belief. It's creativity. The left brain is logical. It's linear. And when you see that wing disc in Egypt, that comes from ancient Bulgaria. That is each side, one is the left, one is the right. They called it the left eye of Horus and the left right eye of Horus. And in the middle is the synthesis of the two. That is the real meaning of the hidden name of Jesus, which the middle letter is Shin. That is the integration of the two sides. You're never one right side or one left side. It's not linear. It's not all creative. You have to synthesize both. And that is the true teaching of the mystery schools of Egypt and Christianity. You have to synthesize the creativity and the faith with the logic and the linear, and then you have an integrated whole. So when we're dealing with these issues of the bioresonance or the hologram, ideally it's going to integrate both creatively and linearly, logically, scientifically, and then you really have something. You've got a fully realized, complete human being.
Okay, I have a question which has to do with the Romanian find. I'm wondering whether or not they've ever revealed any information that wasn't in the books to you that you might be able to share here on the air. Because in the book, as I said, you know, it was pretty limited. They only went in so far. They said Caesar kept saying that there were certain things he couldn't reveal. Therefore, Radu Sinemar couldn't know about them, first of all, and couldn't report them, secondly. So, and sort of part of that question is whether or not they ever, Caesar, for example, ever encountered beings in there.
Beings in the chamber?
Mm-hmm.
Not, it's a very good question. Not to my question, not to my knowledge. What I would say is, I've had a correspondence with Radu. I haven't actually heard from him since Christmas. But the one of the things he told me was that Caesar at some point left Department Zero. You learn in Book 4 that Radu becomes the administrative head of Department Zero, keeping in mind he's a civilian who enters Department Zero. He doesn't really enter it full-fledgedly until Book 4, which is not printed yet, still being translated and edited. But Caesar, Radu becomes head of Department Zero. Caesar leaves. He goes, and he very much considers Caesar his mentor. Caesar goes to the Inner Earth. He must take the tunnel to the Inner Earth, where he becomes an ambassador of sorts to the beings down in the Inner Earth. Which I believe would be tied to the blue race, tied to Shambhala, at least tangentially.
Okay, when you say the blue race, you mean the Syrians?
No. The Syrians might be tied. I'm talking about the blue indigenous race of that's supposed to be in the underworld. I've written I don't know if you've even read my later books. I've written a lot about the blue race in books like The Black Sun and the Montauk Book of the Living, about Rh negative blue bloods. This is not the David Icke ideas about shape-shifting reptilians. This is a historical antecedents of the human race that had colonized from Mars. They would ostensibly tie to the Syrians through the Martian connection, but they're not known as Syrians per se. They're the blue race. And I'm not told this, but because we have a character, Mashandi, who's a member of the blue race, I would assume that they are tied to that, and the blue race live underneath the Earth because they don't do well in the sun. The sun is what created the disease of leprosy, or Zarath, which we read about in the Jewish holy books, and created what we know now as the white man and the white man's disease. But have I answered your question?
My question was a roundabout answer, but it did touch on it, which is in essence what I was getting is that Caesar did in fact encounter some beings in the tunnel, whatever you want to call it, in the chambers there, and that led him to go into Inner Earth, is what you're telling me. That's
That might be your intuition being correct. It's not.
Right.
It wasn't described as such. Intuition being correct, because he did apparently, or maybe he traveled down that tunnel and met them, or maybe they came up to get him. The army guards are often described as being in front of those tunnels. So, there was obviously more contact than is described, but it's very limited. He did explain to me in a letter that some of his letters were a little morose, that he missed Caesar's, that you know, his mentor was gone and that things had been more challenging. He had some very hard times in Department Zero, and then one of the last letters, he was overjoyed that things looked good, that Caesar would return. Caesar did tell him at one point that he would return, and all of this stuff might come alive in 2013, if it doesn't come alive sooner, with Caesar coming back. And perhaps, you know, it's a delightful story. If it's not all true, it's a delightful story because it has so many theatrical elements that are just like, you couldn't make this stuff up. And
yes.
I admire it much as story as well as I do for the enlightenment and an insight it gives us. And it's very important to point out that this stuff, even though it's somewhat obscure, does revolve around my life. My life is revolving around these characters. They're in my orbit. I'm in their orbit, along with this journey I'm doing to Romania in August with Jeanette Crowley, which is I'm going to be meeting all sorts of people I don't know. And that's always interesting, who will be telling me this, that, about Romania and other aspects, perhaps, of this that I don't know.
Okay. Well, and aren't you leading a trip? Isn't that a trip where people can actually join you that are listening? Could if they wish?
I'm not leading the trip. I'm like a hired guide to be on it. Jeanette Crowley is a spirit medium, a very, very nice woman. And she is JeanetteCrowley.com, gives the, I think it's called the Transylvania Tour. We'll be going to the Sphinx. We'll be going to Mount Omu on August 12th. We'll be going to the cave nearby, totally intriguing cave of Zalmoxis. And we'll be traveling up to the Sarmizegetuza, the holy capital of ancient Transylvania, and assorted other things that are listed on that trip, which you can see her website for more information if anybody wants to come along and have some high adventure. I will be there for the entire trip. And I will be adding my expertise that she has requested me some 2 years ago to come on this, and it finally finalized this summer.
Okay. There's someone in the chat asking if you know how dimensionals are said to take freshly drowned bodies and animate them. Is this anything that you want to talk about?
Well, you know, that's zombie territory. I mean, anything's possible under the sun, and that sounds like a particular area of, occultism that certainly I haven't tried to raise the dead personally. I can't add anything to that except to say that, you know, it might exist and it might not be a desirable thing to get involved in, but...
There's another question here. What references to this blue race do we have on Earth now? It's kind of a corollary to the other question.
What references?
What relationship does humanity have to the blue race? When you say it's Rh negative, it's related to the Rh negative. Are you talking about that would be how humanity presently, there are individuals who have Rh negative blood, certainly on the planet.
That is a derivative, yes. The Rh negative is not indigenous to this planet, that they've been able to trace it. Like most blood is Rh, meaning it has the rhesus factor. Most people have monkey blood. When you're Rh negative, you've got an Rh factor, which indicates you did not come or have that aspect of your bloodline was not with monkeys. And I've traced this very succinctly with information historically in the book, the Montauk Book of the Living. And there are many records. Look up the Blue Fugates of Kentucky on the internet if you want to get some information. The Blue Fugates, they're a family of Kentucky, of the Blue Bloods of Kentucky. There's a lot of coincidence between the Blue Bloods of Kentucky, which was called Transylvania. It was to be the 14th colony of the United States, and Transylvania, which is where Mary Queen of Scots' ancestry came from, Transylvania. She was Rh negative, and she had the Blue Bloods disease known as porphyria, as did King George, her descendant.
Okay.
King George III.
We are actually running out of time here, Peter, so I want to thank you very, very much for coming on and discussing these books. Everyone who's been listening, I'm sure, will be quite fascinated, and people that are able to, these shows go on, people listen to them all the time, and you're certainly welcome to.